Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your listening post for politics, Iowa style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We're glad you're with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, I say it every week, but it is good to have you on board again.
Yes, good to be here, Dennis.
I know you haven't had much sleep because there was a late night judicial decision on Sunday night as we go live on Monday night. And this one really jumped in and upended the Democratic senatorial primary against Chuck Grassley. Abby Finkenauer ruled by a judge not eligible to be on the primary ballot. This is a major decision. Let's unpack this one.
Yes, I almost gave up waiting for Judge Scott Beatty to come down with his decision. He said that he thought he would decide it on April 10th, and it was after 11 p.m. on April 10th, and it was quite a ruling. So as you say, he determined that the state objection panel made the wrong decision. They used the wrong legal standard when they evaluated the disputed signatures for Abby Finkenauer, and that therefore she had not met the legal threshold in his opinion. So the campaign and the state of Iowa, which is representing the state objection panel, appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court, and they're moving very quickly. They're going to hear oral arguments on Wednesday. I anticipate the Supreme Court to hand down a ruling probably on Friday.
Let's talk about what happened here. The judge ruled that she did not have enough valid signatures on her nominating petitions in two counties. And the problem, of course, emanates from the campaign and from Finkenauer, because honestly, she didn't get enough extra signatures to allow for some to be disqualified in those two counties.
Yes, I mean, this is the biggest mystery about the whole thing, is how the campaign, which has a paid staff, they turned in their papers a week early, and yet they were just barely over the 100 signature threshold in many of the counties. The U.S. Senate candidates are required to have 3,500 signatures total. She was way above that, but they also had to have at least 100 signatures in at least 19 counties. She was over that number in 20 counties, but in several of them, just barely over 100. So as we've discussed in the past, it is very easy for signatures to be excluded for any number of reasons, just a little bit of information missing from the top of the page. Duplicate signatures are fairly common. Other issues like the voter not realizing that they're signing in the wrong county, or they maybe don't live in the right district. So any campaign knows you usually try to collect 20 to 25% more than what you think you will need just to make sure that you have that cushion.
So Finkenauer was considered the front runner for the Democratic nomination in the fight to beat U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, the Republican, in the fall. Now, the other two Democrats, the retired Navy Admiral Mike Franken and Minden City Council member Glenn Hurst, they probably can't believe their good luck today.
Yes, I mean, it is, I would say Abby Finkenauer is still the front runner if she manages to stay on the ballot. She has raised the most money, although Mike Franken said that he raised $1.4 million in the first quarter, and we don't know how much Abby Finkenauer raised. We'll find that out next week. But I mean, she's raised a lot of money. She has a lot of endorsements. She's run more campaigns in the past. So, but right now, the Iowa Supreme Court, we don't know how they'll decide this. I mean, on the one hand, they do tend to defer to state agencies, so that would suggest that they might uphold the panel's decision. On the other hand, they might well agree, considering that six of the seven justices are conservatives. It's very possible that they will agree with the reasoning that this district court judge laid out last night.
So on this Monday night, as we go live, her candidacy is hanging, as we have said before, by a thread.
Yes, it is. I mean, the good news for her is that the state objection panel, the way they dealt with her signatures is similar to the way they've been handling signatures like that since 1988, a signature that is otherwise valid but is missing a date. The state panel has said in the past that that can be counted if they can infer the date by other signatures on the same page. And that's what they did. So they didn't depart from their precedent at all. But what the district court judge found last night was that the state panel all this time has been using the wrong standard, in his opinion, and that instead of using a substantial compliance standard, they should be using a strict compliance standard. And the Finkenauer campaign just did not strictly comply with the guidelines.
We certainly will have a lot to talk about next Monday night on this broadcast based upon this decision. Meanwhile, something else we're going to talk about next Monday night, we should talk about tonight. President Biden coming to Iowa tomorrow, Tuesday, going to visit an ethanol plant in Menlo. And the speculation is, that's 45 minutes west of Des Moines, by the way, it's going to be his first trip to Iowa since the 2020 election. The speculation is he's going to have a big announcement about one of our favorite topics, E15 ethanol.
Right. And you wonder, well, the president doesn't come to Iowa very often. And when he does, you don't think that he's going to go to a town with about 345 people. But here he is, as you mentioned, the thinking is that ethanol is going to be high on the agenda. And also Menlo happens to be in Guthrie County. That's a little bit outside KHOI's listening area, but it does happen to be in the 3rd Congressional District, where Representative Cindy Axne was an early endorser of Joe Biden. And she has been a very vocal supporter of ethanol. And I expect that she will be on hand and will be very happy to share in the publicity of what's going to be announced tomorrow.
You know, it's interesting, the president coming to Iowa, when the latest Des Moines Register poll showed his approval rating is 35%, 59% oppose what he's doing. Not a surprise in Iowa, but he really is at a low ebb here.
He is, but I think that since the 3rd District is one of the most targeted in the country, and of the U.S. House Democrats, their majority is very narrow. And so President Biden is probably going to be out there appearing alongside of many of the congressional Democrats that have been targeted. And so I do think that that is, although it's not primarily a political trip, I do think that the itinerary is not a coincidence. I mean, there are ethanol plants all over Iowa, but the fact that he chose one in Guthrie County strikes me as not coincidental.
You are correct, of course, yes. Oh, there was so much big news last week. Iowa's two Republican U.S. senators, Chuck Grassley, Joni Ernst, voted against confirming Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court. She was approved, of course, on a 53-47 vote. Not a surprise that Grassley and Ernst voted against her, but a lot of people thought maybe Grassley maybe would cross the party line. He did not.
No, yeah, I don't know that how many people really thought that he would this time. He had voted to confirm her to the district court when she was appointed by Barack Obama. She was unanimously confirmed at that time. She's very highly qualified. But I think from the opening day of the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearings, and Chuck Grassley plays an important role in those because right now he is the ranking Republican on that committee, he indicated in his opening remarks that judicial philosophy is very important to him. And it was fairly clear that he wasn't going to be a supporter of Judge Brown Jackson's judicial philosophy. Now, interestingly, she said that she doesn't really have a philosophy. She has what she described as a methodology. The way she approaches cases is she doesn't have a certain philosophy in mind, but she looks at the facts and the law and determines them on a case-by-case basis.
You know, the Republicans, as we talked last week, had turned that hearing basically into another stage for the culture war that's taking place across the country.
Yes, they did. And the sentencing, the criminal sentencing was a big issue. And in the statement, the floor speech that Chuck Grassley gave explaining why he had decided to vote against the judge, he did spend a fair amount of time talking about sentencing, what he described as her lax approach to sentencing, and not specifically in the child pornography cases, as some of his Republican colleagues harped on. But he did mention that he felt that she went below the prosecutor's guidelines. From what I was reading is that a lot of federal judges, including some judges who Trump appointed to courts of appeals, who Senators Grassley and Ernst voted to confirm when President Trump appointed them, it is not at all unusual for federal judges to go below the sentencing guidelines for some of these crimes, especially for some of the child pornography crimes, because the technology is different and some of those laws and sentencing guidelines haven't really been revised for the internet age we live in.
Right. And one more on this. Senator Ernst said she's going to cast the no vote because Jackson would not commit to maintaining any particular judicial philosophy, which strikes me as being saying, we don't want you to be flexible. You just have to maintain a rigid code no matter what the case is and what the circumstances are.
Yes. I mean, she mentioned a lot of things. She did. She started out talking about that. And then she said that she was concerned about that the judge didn't have a consistent record on life issues. Of course, that's code for abortion. She then talked about, she did talk a little bit about child pornography, and she brought up a few other things. She said she was concerned that the judge, by the judge's answer to the question of what is a woman. And so, you know, that seemed to come out of left field during the hearings. I don't know that any nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court has ever been asked a question like that. But of course, across the country, Republicans have been trying to highlight transgender equality issues. And that was clearly where that question was going during those hearings.
We certainly want to reassure people that there is no child pornography on this broadcast. Never had it, never going to have it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Iowa's entire congressional delegation co-sponsored legislation last week in Congress to improve the outdated National Weather Service communications system. That proposal coming, of course, after the Weather Service reported delays during a series of tornadoes that moved through the state last month. So people really want to get some answers on this one.
Yes, I mean, it's a no-brainer because in a severe weather situation, I mean, every minute makes a difference to whether somebody can get to shelter, particularly if they live out in the country. They just may not be very close to any shelter. So that is a high priority, and I wasn't surprised to see that that one was unanimous.
Right. Governor Reynolds making a big announcement late last week, really big. The Glenwood Residential Facility for People with Severe Disabilities going to close in a couple of years. This facility has been troubled for so long. There have been investigations into abuse and poor medical care, but this still came out of left field, this announcement.
Yes, I was surprised to hear that it was coming. I mean, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a report in December that was fairly damning, saying that the state of Iowa was violating the rights of people with disabilities, with severe disabilities, and that there was substandard care in these two institutions that are remaining in Glenwood and in Woodward. And I heard a lot of mixed things last week that I'm not an expert on this issue. And so I was looking to some people who are advocates within the disability community, and there's a lot of disagreement. So some people share the concerns expressed in that Department of Justice report that Iowa is institutionalizing too many people and should be investing in more community-based services. But on the other hand, some of the people living at Glenwood have very severe issues, and there may not be any community-based program anywhere in the state of Iowa that can meet their needs. And so there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen. Some of the residents, about 150 residents, some of them may move over to the Woodward Resource Center in central Iowa, but I just don't know. And I think that it's unfortunate that the state legislature was supposed to have oversight hearings on what was happening at Glenwood in March of 2020. It was literally scheduled for March 16th of 2020. And of course, that's when the legislature shut down because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And that oversight hearing that was supposed to happen was never rescheduled. And it just made me wonder if they had rescheduled that and maybe gotten some answers and made some changes, maybe the DOJ wouldn't have found so many problems at the facility last year when they were looking at it.
Right. Now, there's no indication here, again, as to what's going to replace Glenwood. As you say, they may move some of the residents there to Woodward and some residential facilities maybe in the community. But you have to be careful about what you wish for. As those who have wanted this place shut down, what do you replace it with? I know California back in the 1960s and 70s under Governor Reagan shut down mental health facilities because they were horrible. Those people went to the streets. There was no other place for them.
Right. And I mean, when our climate is even that much worse for people to be living on the streets, not that that should ever be an acceptable place for anyone to live, let alone somebody with severe mental health issues. So it's a problem. I mean, Iowa has not heavily invested in community-based mental health services. We're not high on the state, the national rankings in that regard either. So even though the Reynolds administration has promised to invest more, there's not a lot of time to scale this up before this facility is going to close.
Right. We'll be following this one, as we will this next story. The state Senate voted last week to spend $1 million on pregnancy support groups that oppose abortion. Practically a party line vote. Every Republican senator voted in favor, joined by two Democrats. So here we go. Another effort to curtail abortion.
Yes, they actually scaled it back. The original bill was for $2 million. They scaled it back to $1 million. But this was a very tough one for Democrats because Democrats have been fighting for years to expand postpartum Medicaid coverage, which currently in Iowa is for up to 90 days. And the standard, the national recommendation is really that that should be for 12 months, that that's better for maternal health outcomes and for babies' outcomes when you give women the postpartum coverage for 12 months. So it's something that they've been fighting for in a Republican-controlled legislature. Of course, Democrats don't get much of what they want. And so they finally had a bill that Republicans were moving that would expand Medicaid coverage for the postpartum period to 12 months. And then Republicans attached this rider on it that would spend $1 million on state funding for these crisis pregnancy centers, which of course no Democrat is ever going to support. So it was just a very, very tough thing. And Democrats were complaining that the Iowa Department of Human Services Director Kelly Garcia oversaw a similar program in the state of Texas, and that there was all kinds of mismanagement and waste of money and no accountability to see that the pregnant women actually got valuable services through these centers that were getting a lot more state money.
Yes. Well, it's 15 after the hour, giving you a time check. Wherever you're listening to us, you're in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. We are here every single week at this time to talk about politics Iowa style and how it's affecting all of us. We have 15 minutes to go and a lot to get into, so let's jump on again. State House last week voted to change Iowa's mobile home park law, again, passing largely on party lines. Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed. Let's download that one.
This has been tough because there have been several mobile home or manufactured housing parks in recent years that have been bought up by national chains, and then immediately the rent gets raised by a large amount, sometimes several times in a year. And in Iowa, owners of manufactured homes, who they still have to pay to rent the land, and they don't have anything like the same kind of rights that people who rent apartments have. And so this has been something that people in the legislature have been working on for several years. In fact, even some Republicans have been working on it. It's not just a partisan issue, but they keep running into the buzzsaw of the mobile home park lobby. And that's what happened with this bill. So this bill would really make very small changes. So the required notice for rent hikes would increase from 60 days to 90 days, but it doesn't limit how often they can raise the rent. And remember that a lot of people living in manufactured houses are on a fixed income, or they might be getting disability. Many of them are retired. And so they just don't have a lot of capacity to absorb a big rent increase. And also, though we think of mobile homes as being mobile, in fact, many of them are not very mobile. Once things start deteriorating, once they're more than a few years old, they're not as mobile as people believe. So they don't have the ability either to just pick up and put their house somewhere else.
Yep. Bill now is waiting for passage in the state Senate. State legislature sent a bill to Governor Reynolds for her signature last week, both houses passing it, one that would strengthen penalties for abusing Iowans who are 60 years old and older. And this bill passed both chambers of the legislature unanimously, a rare vote indeed.
Yes, and the AARP has been working on this one for years. They were very happy to see this one finally go through. You wonder, something like this, why does it take years? Because it seems like nobody is really against this. And in fact, I mean, why would people be against making it harder for someone to financially exploit seniors? And so, yes, it definitely, no question that Governor Reynolds is going to be signing this bill.
Elder abuse affects about 1 in 10 people who are 60 and older, and it's often underreported. This is one of those things that goes under the radar most often.
Yes, it really does. And people who are the victims of elder abuse have very little capacity to advocate for themselves.
Right. Well, we know that the 100th day of this year's legislative session is a week from this Tuesday. That's when the lawmakers' daily allowance for lodging and meals goes away. And normally that's a time when they really try to adjourn, but that is not going to happen this year. They are not going to adjourn a week from this Tuesday.
Yeah, I really can't remember that. 2010, I think, was the only year that they got out of town before those per diems expired. They usually, the per diems that the legislators receive expire and the pages go home, stop working. So that's supposed to be incentive for them to really wrap it up. But it just seems like even with a trifecta, they never seem to get their work wrapped up when their per diems are done.
Right. Well, let's talk about what still needs to be resolved before they can go home. One of them, the state budget.
Yeah, so we still have it. It's a little bit unclear, but the Senate and House Republicans still aren't fully on the same page on their global budget targets, let alone some of the specifics in those bills. And so there is going to be some horse trading going on there, and it's not clear what's happening. But the Senate, I think, is holding off on floor votes on some of those budget bills, waiting for the House to move some of their bills forward.
Another one that still has to be adjudicated, shall we say, in the legislature, K-12 transparency, something the governor wants.
Yes. And I think that, I mean, some sort of bill, this is one where I can say, in addition to the state budget, this is definitely going to happen, something in the realm of a public school transparency. And it may not change current law that much. It may be more of an optics than a substantive change, but they will surely be able to agree on something. They're working on the language, and they want to make sure that it doesn't cause more problems than it solves.
But what about the governor? Another one of her really wants private school tuition assistance from public money. Now, that's controversial. Are they going to reach an agreement on that?
I don't know. I heard that the governor has been having one-on-one meetings with some of the Iowa House Republicans who are holdouts on this bill. I continue to hear that Republicans do not have 51 votes for this kind of, whether you want to call it vouchers or student first scholarships or education savings accounts, that the technical name in the current bill is the student first scholarship, but the concept is the same. So it's public money that would go that parents could take that money and apply it toward private school tuition. And there are a lot of people in smaller school districts who think that that would disadvantage, they would lose the money. And yet there aren't even any private schools in their area. So they would lose money for people who would choose to homeschool. And these smaller school districts can't absorb a funding cut like that. So remember, the Republicans have 60 seats in the Iowa House. They need 51 to pass a bill. And what I hear is they still don't have it. But the governor is working this one hard. She really wants to be able to run on this accomplishment this year.
So this is one that Laura Bellin is saying on this Monday night, April 11th, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. So right now, I would say better than 50-50 that it's not going to happen. But you can, I mean, the governor does have a lot of leverage, and there are things she can promise people if they change their votes on it. But the rural superintendents and the rural school boards, many of them are very against this happening. And those are large employers in a lot of these rural school districts. I mean, rural legislative districts, rather.
Another issue that still needs resolving, unemployment benefits reductions. The governor would like to cut it down from 26 weeks to 16.
They're very close on this one. There's really only the House and the Senate bills are very similar. So 26 weeks to 16 weeks maximum, some changes to eligibility. The main sticking point is that the House bill would not impose a one-week delay in receiving benefits, and the Senate bill would. And I think that the Senate is holding this out as to trade for something else that the House agrees to pass. So, but I'm not sure what. But that I feel like the two sides are not very far apart. And I would guess that the Senate will end up agreeing to pass the House version of this bill in exchange for something else that gets through the lower chamber.
And that would be the one-week delay?
Right. So the 1 week, meaning the House bill doesn't have that 1 week delay. So the House bill would leave things as they are, that Iowans could at least start collecting unemployment immediately instead of having to wait 1 week. The Senate bill, that's not what they want, but I think that's something they'll give up if they can get the House to pass one of the bills they really want.
Okay. We talked about E15 a few minutes ago. President Biden may be going to make a big announcement about it tomorrow. But one of the things the state legislature still has to resolve is an E15 ethanol mandate.
I still don't have a good read on this. The bill is through the House. I don't have a good read on whether there is substantive opposition in the Senate or whether the Senate is waiting because, again, they want to use this as part of a grand bargain toward the end of the session. This is one, I like to call it a clash of the lobbying titans, where the retailers really don't want this. Some conservative interest groups like Americans for Prosperity is one. They really don't like this. The fossil fuels companies don't like it. On the other hand, the big ag lobby groups, the corn growers, the soybean growers, the biofuels manufacturers, of course, they want this. So something I'm not sure, you know, I think better chance, there's better than a 50-50 chance that this will end up getting to the governor. The governor does want to sign some sort of bill that would require gas stations to sell this E15 ethanol, maybe with some exemptions for those small, older gas stations.
Yep. And your favorite bill, the bottle bill, which has only been hanging around for 40 years or so, still no resolution. Are they going to do it this year?
I just don't know. Like I said, I continue to bet against the bottle bill happening. But I mean, it's possible they'll come to an agreement. The key senator and representative have said that if it doesn't happen this year, maybe next year, they'll just repeal it. And a lot of people don't want this bill repealed. So we'll see. Right now, the two different versions floating around would probably lead to less recycling, not more, because they would allow grocery stores to accepting those cans and bottles back. And a lot of people just don't have a redemption center near them. They're not going to be taking their cans and bottles somewhere else. They're just going to be tossing them.
What would we do on this broadcast if we couldn't talk about the bottle bill every year? What would we do? All right. The American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa last week sent letters to Coralville, Dubuque, Davenport, and Bettendorf. Why, you say? Demanding that those cities stop enforcing bans on begging on the street or panhandling, and take steps to repeal ordinances. Wow, that's a threatening letter. What was that all about?
It is. Well, I mean, I think it's a letter. We're putting you on notice now. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that governments, local governments, can't regulate speech, and that it does certainly sound like a speech restriction to say that people can't ask for money on the street. So I think that this is a precursor to potentially filing suit against these cities. Most cities would prefer not to be sued. So we'll see what happens. But Coralville, as you say, Dubuque, Davenport, and Bettendorf, now they have an opportunity to change their ordinances if they want to. Certainly, if they want to take litigation off the table, this is a signal to them, repeal your ordinances now.
We'll be following, as we do almost everything here. Okay, let's get into the coronavirus. Mixed numbers last week. State officials reported 930 new cases of the virus in Iowa. That's double the previous week's rate, but still below the pandemic's peak. Also, 9 new deaths. So the new subvariant of the subvariant of the variant, you know what we're talking about, is is really hitting Iowa now.
Yes, it is. It's very highly contagious. I have seen people who track the wastewater have said that the levels of coronavirus in wastewater does seem to be creeping up as well. And that usually shows up before people even test positive, and certainly well before you'd see it reflected in hospitalizations. Now, the hospitalizations are still so, so low. They're even lower than the lowest point that they got after 2020, in the summer of 2021. This is really a low point. So, but it's very contagious. And as we're seeing on the East Coast, New York City, Boston area, and Washington, D.C., they are having some pretty big outbreaks after large indoor gatherings. So it sounds like the CDC guidance is a bit confusing for people now. I certainly am going to be continuing to wear my mask if I'm indoors in a public place.
And I just want you to know I got my fourth shot, my second booster shot last week, as did my wife.
Congratulations.
We are fully boosted, and so I expect to be able to survive this. Philadelphia, by the way, is announcing that it's going to reimpose a mask mandate this week.
Oh, wow. Well, the number, like I said, on the East Coast, the numbers are definitely going up.
Yep. In relation to this, the family of a JBS pork processing plant employee in Marshalltown filed a lawsuit, a troubling lawsuit. It's a family of Jose Andrade Garcia, 21-year JBS employee, not 21 years old, contracted the virus, died in May 2020, and the family says that there are photos that show employees sharing tables without any barriers or masks in that pork processing plant.
I remember when he passed away, it was so sad because he was just days or weeks from retiring. He was so close to retiring when he fell ill. And so I remember also at the time that LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, this JBS plant in Marshalltown was one that they highlighted, that they filed an OSHA complaint, that there were just no precautions. People were given either nothing or they were maybe given a bandana to wear over their nose and mouths, and the conditions inside a pork processing plant, the humidity there. I mean, it's just almost people working shoulder to shoulder. It's just ideal for spread of a respiratory virus.
We'll be following that one. Now, another relationship to coronavirus, the former Iowa governor, current U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, tested positive for it last week.
Yes, and he had attended that Gridiron Dinner, which is a very fancy, prestigious event annually in D.C., and now I think they have more than 70 confirmed cases of people who have tested positive after attending that event. And so he said that his symptoms were mild, that he's fully vaccinated and boosted, and he was encouraging everybody to get vaccinated and boosted. And I mean, I certainly wish him a speedy recovery. I mean, the tricky thing is that people who become infected, they may spread it to others who are more vulnerable, perhaps aren't vaccinated, or maybe they have health conditions that meant that even with a vaccine, they didn't build up the antibodies. So it does go to show that there are still risks to having those large indoor gatherings.
We have only a minute. This is a very quick one. The National Environmental Group Food and Water Watch estimated that 3 proposed carbon capture pipelines in Iowa could receive $23 billion in federal tax credit over a dozen years. Another shot in the battle over these carbon capture pipelines.
Yes. And I mean, it's the groups that are proposing these pipelines are not groups that have been looking at climate solutions for years, and this is the latest thing. This is more like people who have been investing in energy, and so this is a way to capitalize on some federal subsidies. So this is as a land use issue, I think that's where it's gaining the most traction in Iowa, the opposition to the pipelines. But also as a subsidy issue, I think that we're going to be hearing more about that as well.
15 seconds. What are you looking for this week besides Abby Finkenauer and Joe Biden?
I was just going to say that the main thing is going to be that Iowa Supreme Court ruling. It could set a really important precedent for Iowa in terms of ballot access for future elections. So I don't think I certainly wouldn't underestimate the importance of that. It's much more important than just this one U.S. Senate race.
You betcha. We're out of time. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will zoom right back here in this time slot next week. We promise. When we'll have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. And trust us, there's a lot going on. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We truly value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy Easter.